It's Diane. On my mind, the Secret Service. We see them surrounding the president, mostly men in dark suits wearing earpieces and sunglasses. The agents are tasked with protecting the most powerful people in the country. But Carol Lenick, Pulitzer Prize-winning reporter at The Washington Post, says the agency may no longer be up to the job. In a new book titled Zero Fail, The Rise and Fall of the Secret Service, Lenick traces the history of the agency from its founding in 1865 to its transformation after the assassination of John F. Kennedy into an elite, highly trained unit, to the scandals and missteps of the Obama and Trump administrations. I talked with Lenick Thursday morning about the shortcomings of the agency and what's needed now. Carol, the title of your book and the subtitle, The Rise and Fall of the Secret Service, is certainly provocative. Take us back to when and how and why the Secret Service began.
It's interesting, Diane, because we all associate now the Secret Service with the Hollywood image, the earpiece, the sunglasses, the silent, you know, very trim and fit suited men that are protecting the president's life. But the Secret Service actually began in 1865, not many months after, ironically, Abraham Lincoln was assassinated. The idea for the agency was really to resolve a pressing economic crisis in the country. Two-thirds of the paper currency in the country at that time was counterfeit because of the Civil War, because of incredible counterfeiters. And the goal of these federal agents was to knock out these printing presses that were really playing havoc with the financial state of the country. It was already pretty vulnerable. But, you know, three presidents would be assassinated before the Secret Service would take on a new and specific role of protecting the president. And the main reason was that presidents in that fledgling state, the first, century of our country, really resisted the idea of a Praetorian Guard. They didn't want to be seen as royals. They wanted to be seen as men of the people. And so agents protecting them was not something they would countenance, and they resisted it at every turn. It was not until President McKinley was killed in Buffalo at the equivalent of a World's Fair that finally the Congress and the White House decided they had to do something.
Is that the primary role then of the Secret Service now?
So, excellent question. And indeed, today it is considered the primary role, and it certainly uses a lot of the $2 billion budget that the Secret Service has allotted to it each year. But it is unfortunately by far not the only mission. The Secret Service protects 40 more people. Under President Trump, it hit a record of 42 people in addition to the president, cabinet secretaries, national security officials, Steve Mnuchin, the Secretary of Treasury at the time, who had no threats against his life, had a full-time security detail, presidential grandchildren, vice presidential stepchildren. So enormous, enormous assignments, as well as, in the 90s, President Clinton gave the Secret Service the job of protecting large gatherings of the public that would likely be targets of terror. They protect Super Bowls and Olympics. On top of that, they have their legacy mission, which is protecting counterfeiting and now investigating much more sophisticated cyber crimes and financial hacking of secure economic systems.
So, how large is the Secret Service now, do we know?
It has about 7,000 staff members. Some of them are agents. Many more are officers. And then there are quite a few like technicians and administrative staff. And it has, as I said, about a $2.2 billion federal budget. To put that in context, though, it sounds like a lot of money, but it's essentially what would pay for building one fighter jet.
So a great many of those within the Secret Service felt a huge failure when President Kennedy was assassinated. How did they see themselves as failing?
You know, to abuse a term from 9/11, I think they all felt very guilty about the failure of imagination, the failure to conceive, because they had been warned for months before Kennedy's being gunned down in Dallas, that he was a target of all sorts of groups, and that indeed a white supremacist who was caught on tape by a FBI informant had warned he and his ilk were hoping to shoot President Kennedy from a high-rise building, which is basically exactly what happened. So he's in an open car, you know, he's driving through a town fairly slowly in order to better greet all the voters that he hopes will vote for him in his reelection. This is the kickoff of his reelection tour in the fall of 1963. And the agents are not prepared for that. They haven't scanned the lines of sight to how to kill him. And their agency, at least, if they not personally, have been warned about the method by which Kennedy was shot down in front of them. They're also not trained at that point for sort of the split-second reactions that are necessary. If you've watched the Zapruder film, as so many have, there is a pause, a painful pause, where agents are looking around behind them at the sound of gunfire. Instead of taking immediate steps, as they do now, to cover and evacuate the president.
Extraordinary that despite, as you say, these threats that had been coming, that they did not investigate the area around the path where he was driving. A failure of imagination is quite a phrase applied there. Could you also say it was a failure in terms of not having enough people to do the kind of thorough investigation of that area?
1,000%. And I'm glad you mentioned it, Diane. In the year before Kennedy was assassinated, the director of the Secret Service had essentially been, you know, as politely as he could, begging for additional resources and particularly additional agents. I think that's one of the things that's the through line in the Secret Service history. The agents knew they were being run ragged. I mean, President Kennedy was a dashing figure. He and his wife loved to meet people, although she was an introvert. They still constantly were traveling the world, the country, and they had a go-go metabolism for travel and visits, and there were not enough agents to protect them all. In fact, there's sort of a painful moment where one agent who unfortunately died during my research, but was one of the Kennedy protective agents, told me that he used to take a suitcase with him on a trip, drop off the suitcase at his home with his wife, and she would have a new fresh one ready for him to pick up at the door, literally not even touching his head to his pillow at his own home.
At the same time, you report that the agents covering Kennedy, some of them had been out drinking the night before.
Yes, and this became a painful moment in the Warren Commission investigation because a Texas source, not worth going into all the details, but a Texas source who was disturbed by this contacted a columnist of the Washington Post, a syndicated columnist named Drew Pearson, and alerted him that the night before Kennedy had been killed in Fort Worth, Texas, just down the road, essentially from Dallas, a sister city, in a beatnik bar, about 9 Secret Service agents, at least 5 of them that would be with the president the next morning, had been out to all hours of the night, 2 a.m., 3 a.m., 5 a.m., depending on the man, drinking in this place that served grain alcohol spiked cocktails. And, you know, it was a different era then. There was a lot more drinking, a lot heavier drinking. But on top of that, the agents were, you know, trying to relax after a grueling day where they had, in many cases in the last 3 days, jogged or walked as many as 20 miles, following a motorcade, following the president from place to place. And this was a little moment to themselves.
But there was a lot of guilt there.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And I would say the simplest way to describe it is, you know, America was traumatized by that assassination, the loss of a president in gunned down in an American city. But it was a gut punch like no other for the Secret Service, because whether or not they admitted it publicly, inside it killed them. I mean, people became alcoholics, people committed suicide. It was a hair shirt with a lot of pain.
So what kinds of changes were made after that to the Secret Service?
You know, if you think about now, if God forbid one of our presidents were killed, the Secret Service director would lose his job. In this case, Director Rowley, who had been pleading again for the reinforcements and been turned down both by Congress and by the president, absolutely tripled down on rebuilding the agency. And the improvements included, you know, adding 280 agents and staff, literally what he had requested before the death. It included a routinized, rigorous new training. Again, for that split-second reaction, instead of waiting to hear the gunshot and figuring out where's it coming from, literally acting on the moment. It included, computers were new then, but Director Rowley reached out to IBM to try to work through how to computerize the threats so that it wasn't just a random piece of paper filed somewhere, but that everybody had access to the information, as they should have, about that white supremacist in Florida who said, "We're going to shoot him from the top of a building."
Despite the addition of new people, absolutely necessary people, you say that the Secret Service now is not really up to the job. How come?
You know, something sort of tragic happened that nobody was paying attention to, Diane. And that is that the service was vindicated over and over again in the 80s and then the 90s in that rebuild that came after the trauma of Kennedy's assassination. They basically saved Ronald Reagan's life, Gerald Ford's life, and others, because they knew exactly what to do. They'd been trained for that kind of split-second reaction that is so impressive. You know, a person like Tim McCarthy throwing up his chest and his arms to literally take the incoming bullets when he hears them. From John Hinckley that day outside the Hilton when President Reagan was shot, luckily not fatally. So they're vindicated by that. But after 9/11, as the country and Congress decides that the number one threat is terror from abroad, billions of dollars are shoveled into this behemoth new agency, the Department of Homeland Security, to protect us from terror in the skies, make sure we all don't take more than 3 ounces of sun cream, you know, on the plane so that none of us can have some accelerant in our shoe, to make sure that terror is stopped on our borders. And proportionally, over and over again, the Secret Service gets shortchanged. It gets less and less, you know, per person, per mission for the job. And it gets stuck in a status quo where its actual tools are so outdated as to be constantly on the fritz. And its staffing does not come close to the sort of blossoming, enlarging mission that it is given.
You spoke to a number of people for this book. Why do you believe that those within the organization decided to speak out to you?
Initially, they spoke out to me because the Secret Service was in the midst of a humiliating sort of personal morality scandal. And that was a dozen Secret Service agents and officers shipped back unceremoniously from President Obama's trip to Cartagena. And this state visit to Colombia was supposed to be to talk about economic trade deals, etc. But instead, all it became was conversations about how these agents had turned this trip into a boys gone wild bachelor's weekend, prostitutes, over drinking, scary stuff from a morality standpoint, but really scary stuff from a national security standpoint. If you're going to get so hammered as to bring women back to your hotel room whose names you don't know, then you are compromising the mission and compromising the president's safety. There's a risk that all your security plans are going to be breached. They spoke to me about that, but what I learned as I got to know more of them were these horrifying details about how frightened they were about security gaffes and breaches that had been covered up in recent years. And they wanted to talk about those because that worried them the most. They felt that those showed a chink and multiple chinks in the armor. And they believed, sort of despondently, that their leadership wanted to cover this up as well, did not want to admit this, did not want to admit weakness. And because they'd covered up those events, you know, they had reason to doubt whether their leadership was going to take it seriously. Now, remember, Secret Service agents risk their jobs. They can be fired for talking to me or any reporter without permission. And some of them lost their jobs for talking to me.
Oh, really?
A pretty painful thing for me and for them, obviously, much more for them. But that's the kind of dedication that they had to improving their agency.
So knowing that they could lose their jobs, they spoke to you out of concern for the total agency. And did you use particular names or did you have them speak anonymously?
For the book, with rare exception, people who were both former and current agents and officers spoke to me on background. But you know, the standards that we have at the Washington Post are the ones that I applied here in my book, which is that I never rely on one single person to tell me a story. Many of these people who provided this information to me also let me look at their contemporaneous telephone records, their journals. When it didn't involve classified information, they allowed me to see their actual work documents that established and corroborated their accounts. And then they led me to other people who were also firsthand witnesses to what they relayed.
I presume then their superiors found out immediately just who it was who had talked with you.
There are many people they have not, but there were some that they were essentially hunting for individuals who had provided me with embarrassing information. And I think, Diane, that's also, you know, unfortunately, a painful reality about the Secret Service. Instead of looking to fix these problems, the leadership of this agency, and not just one director, but multiple directors, were hunting for the people who were providing this embarrassing information. You know, if only they had turned their lens to solving the problem rather than trying to clog the leak. It's unfortunate that that is such the reaction of government leaders from time to time. When they're embarrassed, this is what they do. But the problem does not go away. In fact, it only festers. And those sources continued. Even after they knew their colleagues had lost their job, sources continued to come to me.
What about the Secret Service capacity, if you will, in covering Bill Clinton during his presidency and what ultimately became a scandal that led to an impeachment trial?
What is so fascinating to me about what I learned from the agents when they were relaying their experience during this time was how President Clinton's, you know, romantic dalliances with a White House intern and his efforts to try to cover that up ran kind of square and smack into the Secret Service's, you know, noble desire to keep the confidences of the president. The reason they want to keep the confidence of the president is not because they want to hide bad things that he did or judge him morally. Or question his adultery. It's because they want to be at his shoulder for that split second reaction when they have to cover and evacuate. And so they never want a president to feel their chattering about his private life. It's a really interesting relationship. But in this instance, as you know, the independent counsel demanded to know what Secret Service's agents and officers had seen at the president's shoulder, because it would help the independent prosecutors establish that President Clinton had lied about never being alone with Monica Lewinsky. I really feel for these agents because it's an impossible place to be. Many of them were furious about then candidate Bill Clinton keeping them at bay, and also as president keeping them at bay. He was a television president, right? He didn't want agents in the backdrop, and they felt they needed to be close to protect him. Like Kennedy, he always wandered into the crowd just headlong. And that was a problem for them.
And I must say, Kennedy's personal life had to have frustrated these Secret Service agents.
So, so true. And an absolute parallel between both of these men on that one point. Again, agents were beside themselves about Kennedy's traveling habits, which were, as soon as he landed in a town, not with his wife, women were brought into his hotel room or whatever place he was staying. And those women were not screened or introduced to the agents. They didn't know their names. They didn't know if they had a vial of some poison in their purse. And so for the agents, again, the issue is, I don't care about your embarrassment as a politician. I care about the fact that on the other side of that door, I'm responsible for your safety. And now you're taking away my ability to do my job. The same was true with candidate Clinton. Agents show up in Little Rock. He's the Democratic presidential nominee on his way to becoming president. Polls show him pulling far ahead of President Bush. And they show up at a YMCA and are told, you really can't go in there. The supervisor says, I'm sorry, we're not going in. Why? The agents ask. Well, because he's meeting a woman here. Again, on the other side of the door, the agents can't protect him. And now you've ruined their ability to deliver on their promise, the zero fail mission.
A quick break. When we come back, the rest of my conversation with Carol Lenig. Here's the rest of my conversation with Carol Lenig. Her latest book is Zero Fail, The Rise and Fall of the Secret Service. What about George W. Bush and his relationship with the Secret Service?
There is almost no family that has a better, presidential family that has a better relationship with the Secret Service than George H.W. Bush and George W. Bush. The love is so mutual and so deep. I attribute that to genuinely what the agents have told me, which is that the family treated them like family, but also was extremely respectful of their role. You know, whatever you say, boss, essentially. That there was a deference to the security decisions of the Secret Service. That makes a difference, right? Your Barbara Bush is out there making sure you're getting coffee and sandwiches when you're at Walker Point. And the president is saying, whatever you need, I will do what you say. So that was quite a twofer. And there are some poignant moments when the Bush families are departing the White House. And the agents are essentially giving their version of a 21-gun salute or a Pentagon clap out. They give a standing ovation for the family's departure. They really did adore them.
And we come to Donald Trump and his relationship to the Secret Service. I understand that, and you mentioned this, that Mnuchin had Secret Service protection during his term in office, and that he still has that Secret Service protection?
Yeah, agents and former directors shake their head at this because there is no threat justification for the detail that he receives. And I'm sure it's very convenient. I'm sure it gets him through airports, very quickly and to, you know, speeds him through towns, but it is not justified and warranted. And it's particularly weird for it to have been extended for 6 months after the inauguration. But Secretary Mnuchin was adamant when Chief of Staff John Kelly went to him and said, look, the Secret Service is going bankrupt. We need to cut some of these details. We have too many of them. Secretary Mnuchin absolutely refused and went to President Trump and Jared Kushner, then Trump's senior advisor, demanding that he be allowed to keep his detail.
And even now, are taxpayers footing the bill for Secretary Mnuchin's Secret Service detail?
Yes, we are. For Secretary Mnuchin, I should say former Secretary of the Treasury, former National Security Advisor Robert O'Brien, former Chief of Staff Mark Meadows, and all of the president's adult children, and ultimately their families, for 6 months after the inauguration, President Biden can choose to extend those details if he wants. I don't know what he'll determine. It is unprecedented for, you know, full-grown adult children who have busy lives, have their own children, to get extended details after the president leaves office. Just as a comparison, Sasha and Malia Obama both lost their details before they graduated college.
This is fascinating. I gather that Donald Trump, because he was traveling so much to his golf resorts and to his various places of entertainment, if you will, had Secret Service detail, as he should. But that must have cost a fair amount of money each time.
It was such an exceptional amount of money, Diane, that the Secret Service in March of 2017, you know, recognizing what was going to be unfolding. The president was going to be traveling to Mar-a-Lago almost every other weekend to golf and relax and also just visit his personal club. That they asked for an emergency infusion of about $33 million in 2017 just to pay for that travel. Now, to put that in perspective, that's half the annual travel budget for the Presidential Protection Division. So an increase of 50% on top of what they normally spend. They also had to ask for another $26 million immediately in March of 2017 because of another choice the Trump family made, which was that Melania Trump decided she was going to remain behind for 6 months at Trump Tower. So for the first time ever in its history, the Secret Service was going to be protecting not a brick rambler in, you know, Oak Park, Illinois, or a ranch in Crawford for President Bush, but a high rise in one of the most, you know, populous tourist districts and one of the most populous cities in America. And, you know, the expense was astronomical.
And continues to be for President Trump. Is that for the rest of his life? And is that the same for his wife?
So a president, a former president, has to designate one residence. So Mar-a-Lago will be the place where you'll see Secret Service agents, assuming that's where former President Trump lives for most of the rest of his life.
And if he travels, how large a contingent of Secret Service will go with him?
It's a tiny fraction of the, you know, entourage, the small city that travels with the president normally. You know, there'll be no need for all of the crew that create a perimeter around a convention center that he visited. There will be no need for the huge team of people who help jam his communications from being intercepted. There's a whole truck that's specially trained for that. There'll be no need for sharpshooters on the rooftops of, you know, homes or clubs that he visits. So it's really ultimately a de minimis number of people and comparatively a tiny expense.
So I would wonder, considering the kind of secrecy that exists within the organization and the kind of secrecy that agents are sworn to keep, there could be difficulties in their marriages, to say the least.
Yes, absolutely. You know, when you say marriages, I'm thinking about the husband and wife, and then I'm also thinking about the president and the Secret Service, their marriage. The husband and wife have a strain because, as you saw with Michelle Obama, before her husband even decided to run, she was convinced it was a bad idea and that he would be killed. She wasn't wrong. The threats against Obama, even before he was inaugurated, were off the charts. Secret Service Director at the time, Mark Sullivan, asked for another emergency infusion of funds because he was so concerned about the first Black president. There were regular meetings once a week, according to a source of mine, between Eric Holder and the White House about the risk to the president's life. So Michelle Obama, according to other sources, President Obama would prefer and would urge his Secret Service detail to try to downplay risk with her, to not make her so nervous.
Yeah.
The marriage between the Secret Service and the president is also an awkward dance because the president wants the voters. The president wants the adoration, and the reelection is built upon that. And the Secret Service wants to create a bubble no one can penetrate. And they end up in a fight, not the Secret Service detail leader and the president, but the Secret Service detail leader and the White House staff on a daily basis about what's safe enough and what the Secret Service will tolerate.
The reason I bring up the question of the marriage of Secret Service agents is because my brother-in-law was a Secret Service agent assigned to Dwight Eisenhower during his presidency. And I often wondered about the amount of secrecy that had to be kept between him and my sister. So
I see.
That's why I raised that question.
Well, I mean, I know this is just funny. I actually met Kennedy agents whose first assignment was with Eisenhower, and they talked about how hard a job it was, how lovely a president he was, but how hard a job it was because, again, even smaller crew, and they were exhausted. So I'm sure that was hard on a marriage. But I also remember an agent telling me that his supervisor on the Kennedy detail said to him, "You're going to see a lot of stuff here," meaning the women. "You're going to see a lot of things. You're going to need to keep them private. And you can't tell anybody, not even your wife." So that must have been quite a burden. And I bet that there are even bigger things, right? Like a potential nuclear strike, a potential strike to kill an enemy that they're there to hear about, and they can't breathe a word.
Can't breathe a single word. What about the breaches, the two breaches at the White House, which could have led to a very serious outcome? I mean, this is more recently that these have happened. How did they happen and what happened afterwards?
You know, a Secret Service director lost her job because a mentally troubled Iraq war veteran who had a limp and was wearing plastic Crocs was able to move from a public sidewalk to inside the White House, deep in the East Room, in 29 seconds. That 18-acre compound is supposed to be the most secure in the world. But somehow, this man was able to get through a place protected by 150 different trained Secret Service professionals.
around the clock.
Yes. And everything failed that day and that evening at dusk. Interestingly enough, President Obama and his two daughters had just lifted off in Marine One off the South Lawn a few minutes before this happened on the North Lawn. You could say everybody was paying attention to the South Lawn, but all of the complex is supposed to be secure. Anyway, Julie Pearson, ultimately, having to testify in hearings, having to answer questions for this, the Secret Service is under a serious cloud, and the president and his staff determine it's time to make a change. And everyone promises, Congress promises, the head of the House Oversight, head of Senate Homeland Security, Department of Homeland Security, three blue ribbon panels, the White House, everybody promises they will fix this. It'll never happen again. And they do add staff and they do add technology. But in March 2017, 2.5 years later, almost the exact same thing happens. Although I would argue it's worse. It's a slightly chilly, rainy Friday night. President Trump is actually upstairs in the residence watching television. He's able to get over these barriers and through the Treasury side of the complex, and he's on the grounds for 17 minutes before he's apprehended. And that is because the technology on the campus is so Keystone Cops. Some cameras are failing, a sensor on the fence is failing, alarms that should be working don't work. It's so bad that this man is able to sit down and tie his shoe. That's how relaxed he is. He jiggles a door on the east entrance to the mansion, presses his face against the window, and then ambles around to the south portico where there are a zillion staircases and entrances straight up to the residence. Even the officer who does apprehend him tries to call for backup and his radio isn't working. That, you know, America can do better and the agents deserve better.
So that becomes the ultimate question. What is it going to take? Is it just money? Is it better training? Is it better leadership? Is it more cooperation between the President of the United States, whoever he or she may be, and the Secret Service? What's it going to take?
You know, if President Biden was on our screen today with us, I would say this agency needs a mission redesign. It needs to not have this enormous plate of duties. And then it needs the tools, the actual tools, not the pretend tools, but the actual tools to deliver on that mission. Number one should always be protecting the life of the president. And that has to be at the top of the food chain. And other things have to fall away. And second, it's always been complicated for presidents to give this agency what it needs because it looks like you're trying to protect yourself from your own people. But I wish President Biden or whomever solves this problem would stop thinking about it that way and start thinking about these public servants. They've given up so much of their lives. They've sacrificed, you know, being in their friend's wedding, having time with their baby children, going to birthdays, celebrating everything. They've given up so much. Give them the tools to do the job that they have sworn they will do.
And what, in your mind, would those tools be?
So first of all, I think a massive upgrade, that mission redesign. They need the technology that all the terror fighting organizations are getting on, you know, in spades. They need more people, although they don't just need more people. They need to rethink that mission, because if they do, they might have enough people to do the job. I think that's it.
And by rethinking the mission, you mean pulling away from all of the extraneous activities that they've been involved in.
Yes, absolutely. I mean, no, there are people in the Secret Service that would sort of get into a fist fight over this. They don't, some very much want to hold on to that historic legacy assignment of financial investigations and crimes. But there are a lot of agencies that investigate financial crimes. And it's hampering their ability to do their protection assignment. And you know, the leadership issue is a big one because the Secret Service likes the status quo. They resist having an outsider as a director. Only during Donald Trump's time in office did they have an outsider, someone who wasn't an agent and came up through the ranks. And that person didn't last very long. Donald Trump fired him fairly quickly. They also need a fresh eye on what they do instead of somebody clinging to the old.
So what's been the reaction from Secret Service leadership to the book?
The current director, James Murray, has said that my book is sort of a rehash of old bad stories about the service, from which he says the agency has greatly improved and evolved. And he insists that the agency is not politicized and that they take any political bias or problematic behavior very seriously.
Hasn't there been a question as to whether a Trump supporter was at the January 6th invasion, if you will, of the Capitol?
What my reporting and my book reveal are that a number of agents and officers, including agents on the president's detail, President Trump's detail, had taken to their own personal social media accounts to promote the theory that Biden was illegitimately elected and to cheer and empathize with the rioters who stormed the Capitol on January 6th. Some of the posts included calling those rioters patriots. Some of those posts included arguing that Donald Trump had been denied his rightful second term by communists and Antifa and liberals who'd stolen the election. And this was so disheartening to some of their colleagues who saw this unfolding that they sent screenshots of these social media postings to me because they feared that they would be eventually deleted. And they sent them to me because their fear was if Secret Service agents responsible for protecting President Biden when he comes in are saying these things, how safe is the democracy? How safe is the incoming president?
So was any action taken?
The Secret Service declined to answer my questions about specific individuals. I have to say I understand a little that it's hard for them to talk about individual personnel cases, but they declined to say if anybody was put on leave or fired, just declined to answer that question about anybody generally. And what they've said since my book has come out is that they take this seriously and they investigate any such claims.
Did the postings have names attached to them?
They did.
So the names of those people who, though they were bound by duty to support the new president, Mr. Biden, were there or were posting these comments. That's really incredible.
It is incredible, especially because, you know, we're a fact-based democracy and we all, you know, believe that this conspiracy theory has absolutely no facts to back it up. It's not a debate. But on top of that, this is a group that swears an oath to the Constitution and swears an oath, as you so rightly said, to protect the man that has been elected. You know, the old Secret Service saying, the people elect them, we just protect them. They're supposed to be above political bias or, you know, they check their political views at the door. Now, this agency definitely leans conservative, leans Republican, like so many police departments and sheriff's departments and law enforcement agencies writ large. That's okay. That's fine. We support that in America. What's worrisome is the what appears to be the dereliction of duty.
I'm just dumbstruck. I really am. I think that your reporting on this is really incredibly valuable, and I do worry for the safety of the president, whoever he might be, considering that you have written so clearly and with such clarity from the individuals themselves about what's going on here. Thank you, Carol. It's good to talk with you.
It was wonderful to talk to you. Thank you for helping, you know, ring the alarm bell for the agents who took this brave step.
That was Carol Lanik, national investigative reporter at The Washington Post. She's co-author of the best-selling book, A Very Stable Genius, Donald J. Trump's Testing of America. Her latest book is Zero Fail, The Rise and Fall of the Secret Service. And that's all for today. You can find us on Facebook and Twitter, or send us an email, theartpodcast@wamu.org. Our theme music is composed by Jim Brunberg and Ben Landsberg of Wonderly. The show is produced by Rebecca Kaufman, Allison Brody, and Sandra Baker. Our engineer today is Natalie Yurev-Lipker. Thanks for listening, all. Be well. Stay safe on this holiday weekend. Enjoy. I'm Diane Rehm.